I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to talk about Hands Across the Sand. It was quite an event in Florida. 10,000 people showed up, and people were shocked. Some people were shocked, I think, about the numbers of people who are concerned about the Gulf spill and what's happening to our beaches and waterways. We are joined by two folks who are involved in that. Alana Wace is a conservation coordinator for the Maryland Sierra Club, and Steve Rivlis is CEO of Campaign Consultants. Did I have that right, Steve?
Campaign Consultation.
Consultation. That's my handwriting. Campaign Consultation. And welcome. Good to have you both here.
Thank you.
So let's talk a bit about this. Steve, I understand that your organization has been involved in this for a while.
From the get-go, yeah. There's a guy, Dave, who owns a couple of restaurants in the panhandle of Florida, who was really upset that Florida had some pending legislation to, for the first time, allow offshore oil drilling off the coast of Florida, and came up with this wild and crazy idea that wouldn't it be neat if we literally drew a line in the sand to say no to offshore oil drilling? This went back to February 13th of this year.
Before the spill.
Before the spill, yeah.
Right.
And he asked us to come on board and help him figure out how to do a viral campaign to get the word out throughout Florida. And in a few short weeks, we were able to organize 90 beach communities and 10,000 people to stand on the beach at noon on the 13th of February and speak out. And the legislature tabled the vote, so the bill didn't pass in Florida. Ironically, almost about the same time, there was similar legislation pending in Maryland. And one of the houses did pass that bill, and it didn't move forward. And then, perversely, the spill happened soon thereafter to kind of point out the danger of offshore oil drilling. And here we are now.
And Alana Wace, the Sierra Club is one of the organizations involved in all this.
Yeah, that's right. We are working to hold an event this coming Saturday, June 26th, at 3:30 in downtown Annapolis, inviting people to come out, join hands for 15 minutes, and say no to offshore oil drilling and say yes to renewable energy and shifting our national energy priorities.
And in the state here, I understand it's going to be in Annapolis and Deal and Ocean City. Is that right?
Yeah. Deal Island and the inlet down in Ocean City as well. And those two events will be at noon, but the Annapolis event will be at 3:30.
There's actually a total of 7 different locations throughout Maryland where these hands events will be occurring. And folks can find out all of this information at handsacrossthesand.org. It's a highly interactive website where you can go in, indicate what state you're in, and it'll print out for you all the different locations in each state of the United States. And we're up to now, I think, 20 or 30 countries as well that are participating on this on June 26th.
I'm looking at our map now of Maryland and the site on the website for Maryland. And it's tell me about, I mean, did either one of you think, especially Steve, since you helped start this, that it was going to be as huge as it's become?
It's a pleasant surprise. It started out small, but it's one of these, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. And this is, I think, one of those great examples where citizens are just kind of tired of hearing finger pointing and reading about one failed attempt after another and want to do something positive and come together and have their voice heard that we need to say no to offshore oil drilling and yes to clean energy. So it's really exciting to see this thing mushrooming. There's 49 states that are participating now. 415 cities are having events. 42 cities outside the United States are participating on June 26th, and 20-some-odd countries are participating.
So I'm
curious. This really has taken on a whole global approach.
It clearly has. And so what do you... I'm curious what both of you, starting with Alana and then over to Steve, what do you both expect to come out of this, though? I mean, this is out of a day's, maybe it's more than a day's demonstration you all are thinking about. What do you think is going to be the impact, result of Hands Across the Sand, Alana?
Well, I think that the best thing that we could wish for is for the message to be heard as loud and clear as it was heard in Florida. And I think the fact that the Florida legislature tabled their legislation to move forward with offshore drilling was a huge success. So similarly for this event, we would like offshore drilling to be moved off the table and instead, really focus on renewable energy. In Maryland, we're very fortunate to be on the Atlantic coast and so close to offshore wind resources to power our state. Our leaders really need to get serious in investing in that instead of the status quo of oil.
Steve?
You're here. It's so frustrating, and at the same time, it's very exciting that we really do have this huge welcome mat of opportunity here for our legislators and citizens to start moving us towards a clean energy agenda.
As you two are talking, I'm looking at the videos on Hands Across the Sands website of people gathering, seeing all these people, hundreds of people, more just lined up across the ocean front, gazing at the ocean, holding hands, saying no to drilling is a pretty amazing sight.
Yeah, it gives me goosebumps when I look at those pictures too. I mean, it just went on for miles in communities all over Florida. So, just imagine if we can do that sort of visual speak out on the 26th and have people say, well, boy, I'm not alone in my view. There are other people here because we're not really hearing from the citizens that much right now. We're certainly hearing from the politicians and certainly from the oil execs. But it's really time for the citizens to be speaking loud and have our leaders start following us.
I mean, isn't that really where it is at the moment? One of the things you just said, Steve Rivlis, is the idea that people feel separated and alone, the idea that people don't realize that there are millions of people who think as they do when it comes to oil drilling and future of energy and our environment and our coasts, and people are not alone. That's one of the key things to this to me.
Yeah, and awareness is an amazing phenomenon. I mean, I consider myself a relatively smart person, but I didn't know where most of our oxygen comes from. I remember learning as a little kid that the trees give off oxygen, but one half of all oxygen is produced by plankton, little microorganisms that hang out in the water. So we're now threatening potentially one half of all the oxygen we all breathe. Sometimes people talk about this as an environmental crisis, and I really think that's the wrong terminology to use. The environment is like weather. We will always have weather. We will always have environment. We just might not have one that's conducive for human life anymore. This is a human crisis that we're experiencing, and we're seeing the very beginning stages of it. And now's the time to do something about it.
And Alana, Wais, talk a bit about, what you're finding in Sierra Club when it comes to organizing these kinds of events and the response you're getting. I mean, you are an organizer, so talk a bit about what you're experiencing.
This has been incredible. We have, our phones have been ringing now ever since the oil spill, and everyone's asking, what are you doing and how can we help? And planning this event has really been a joy just because so many people have come out of the woodwork to help and get involved. I should mention that Environment Maryland and Chesapeake Climate Action Network are also involved for the Annapolis event, but just citizens that may not have even been Sierra Club members are all willing to come up to put up posters, to spread the word, to call their local radio station or just try and get the word out that this event is happening, and just how exciting it is to see how fast this has spread from it started out as just kind of being an Atlantic coast. That was the goal, was to organize these on the Atlantic coast, and now it's spread not only all across the U.S., but internationally. So I think that is a testament to just how ripe this is, that people do feel frustrated that about the lack of progress, both in dealing with the spill, but also in making the switch to cleaner energy sources.
So for folks who want to learn more about where their community is holding such an event, or if they want to volunteer. This is the easiest event to do. You invite your friends, you go to a park, a stream, a river, a lake, or down to the beach or the harbor, and you stand with your friends, you hold hands, so you make a visible statement for 10 or 15 minutes, and encourage others who come by to do it with you. And that's how all this started. It doesn't take much to do it, and you find out about it at handsacrossthesand.org. Or on Facebook, just put in Hands Across the Sand. And in both places, you can find out this information. You can download posters. You can get T-shirts. It's a totally self-organized sort of setup that we're doing here.
And that's where the change is coming in this world. I think from the it's gurgling from the bottom up. And this is
It's gurgling
from
the
bottom up.
Right.
And this is where it is. Hands Across the Sand, as it says on the website, Hands Across the Sand is coming to your beach June 26th. You can, wherever you're listening to this from, just plug in, there's a map there, hit the map of your state, it'll tell you exactly where things are going on, organize your own, let them know how it's happening, and join. We're joined here by Steve Rivlis, who helped organize this thing from the beginning, back in February, and Alana Weiss from right here in Maryland at the Sierra Club. And Steve and Alana, it's been a pleasure. Thank you both so much, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Today on The Mark Steiner Show, we will remember Lucille Clifton. She was Maryland's Poet Laureate from 1979 to 1985 and was a National Book Award winner and a Pulitzer Prize finalist. But her biggest legacy is the beautiful poetry she left behind and the many lives that she touched through her words. Lucille, known for deceptively simple poems that speak volumes about contemporary life, the African-American experience, and womanhood, died in February of this year. Very suddenly, most were not prepared. So we sat down with friends, colleagues, fellow poets to celebrate her life, the great Lucille Clifton, of Baltimore, of Maryland, of the country. This is our remembrance of one of the finest women I ever knew, Lucille Clifton. Wayne Carlin is coordinator of the English department at Leonardtown campus of the College of Southern Maryland. He's a renowned author and writer in his own right and worked a long time with Lucille Clifton.
Thanks, Mark. I knew Lucille for over 25 years. She was a dear friend, and her loss is a great hole in my life, my heart. We would go at least once a week when she was down at St. Mary's before her retirement last year. We'd go to a local cafe with the poet Michael Glazer also, and the three of us would have breakfast and talk about everything. Talk about our writing and poetry, but also the world and grandchildren and her many, many health problems. I miss her very much. I think many people miss her, and many people who never met her miss her because of what her writing meant in their lives. And, you know, her life threw so much at her that I think would have broken and destroyed a lesser spirit. This was both, you know, growing up poor, being poor with many children, being evicted from her house, being abused as a child. All of that wounded her deeply, and then her one medical condition after another. It just amazed me that she was still alive. As long as she lived, she had to have a kidney replaced. Her daughter donated one of her kidneys. She had breast cancer. She had heart conditions. She had gout, diabetes. Every life just threw so much at her. I think she knew if she could find the words to express her personal wounds, that private pain, the words would not only sustain her, but would express the words. The words would not only sustain her, but would express the wounds and pains of many people. people who couldn't find the words because they'd been stolen from their mouths, stolen or burned in front of their eyes, the way her mother's poems once were burned in front of her eyes. She wrote about that in the poem called Fury.
What do you mean her poems were burned before her mother's eyes?
That's, if you want, I can read this poem.
Sure.
Called Fury, and it explains what happened. And it's for Mama, she says. Remember this, she is standing by the furnace, the coals glisten like rubies. Her hand is crying, her hand is clutching a sheaf of papers, poems. She gives them up, they burn, jewels into jewels. Her eyes are animals, each hank of her hair is a serpent's obedient wife. She will never recover. Remember, there is nothing you will not bear for this woman's sake. It was a true story of how her mother would write poetry. You know, her mother hadn't gone, you know, had dropped out before high school and had a very rough life, many kids. And she'd write poems, write poetry for herself. And one day her husband found it and did that and threw them into the furnace in front of her eyes.
Her husband did that?
Yeah, her husband, Lucille's father.
Oh, right.
I
mean, it says a lot about, one of the things that just hit me immediately was about Lucille Clifton, who, as I've said before, I knew because she was my neighbor for so many years when she lived in Windsor Hills, which is the home that she lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember people fighting to help her keep that home.
Yeah.
That if young people would hear her and hear her story, she says a lot about the life you can lead as an artist despite what happens around you.
Yeah. It was what sustained her, and because she could get her quality into her art, it sustained other people. You know, it wasn't just a way of getting out her private pain. That wouldn't have been enough for her. It was a way of connecting it to other people so that they could recognize it. You know, the people who might not be able to find the words, or the people whose words were, you know, were burned up like that. If they could find it for herself, yeah, she was a great teacher and mentor, and she tried to bring that out in people. But she also tried to, to speak for them.
Tell me what you think her place is in our not just the world we're in, but that as well, but just in the world of art and poetry. Tell me where you place Lucille in that, and what she was.
Well, I'd place her in the top ranks of American poets for all of our history. I mean, she was a new voice in that pantheon, but she created that space for herself. She's on a par with any of our great American poets, and the one I most link her to, I guess, is Whitman, in that sense of being able to see in her private pain in her own history a national wounding, a national vision, connect herself to that.
And I know that despite her illness, that her death came, and it was a shock to you. Despite her, whatever she went through, no one was expecting her to leave them, were they?
No, I mean, she'd come through so much, which as I said, should have killed her. And, you know, she wasn't that old. I mean, she was 74 when I saw her. She looked, always in the last few years, she looked tired for many reasons, but you know, that was just Lucille. She just went on and on and on. She was a force. So it was a shock, and it was sudden.
Tell me how you'd like us all to remember her.
I can tell you the way I like to remember her, which is sitting across the table with an impish smile on her face, very very aware of the ironies of the world.
Wayne Carlin, thank you so much. I'm glad you could be part of this memorial to the great poet and human being, Lucille Clifton.
Thank you, Mark.
Let's hear Lucille Clifton reading her work at St. Mary's College of Maryland in 1990.
I want to start with this one because I was talking with Wayne in the car coming here, and he didn't realize that I was born with 12 fingers. And I thought everybody knew that. People have asked me, what is that a metaphor for? And I hardly ever think about metaphor. And I tried to explain, this is not a metaphor for anything. I was born with 12 fingers. And this is a poem about that. I was born with 12 fingers, like my mother and my daughter. Each of us born wearing strange black gloves, extra baby fingers hanging over the sides of our cribs and dipping into the milk. Somebody was afraid we would learn to cast spells and our wonders were cut off, but they didn't understand the powerful memory of ghosts. Now we take what we want with invisible fingers, and we connect my dead mother, my live daughter, and me through our terrible, shadowy hands.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show as we celebrate the life and work of Lucille Clifton, who left us in February, but her work will stay with us forever. We're speaking now with Michael Glazer, a colleague of Lucille's at St. Mary's College of Maryland. He's also a former poet laureate of Maryland.
The night, it was the day after Lucille had died, and she struggled physically within her body, but also in her mind. I mean, I think she felt, as Wayne does, you know, when you talk to Wayne, this profound sadness that nothing we seem to do can fix the world. And in the sky, it was a beautiful evening, and there was the what Wordsworth calls the old moon in the new moon's lap, that wonderful cradle of the new moon. And I thought, how wonderful. You know, Lucille's up there resting and not having to deal with all this stuff that is in our brains about what we're doing to ourselves. It's just amazing.
But she did deal with it, didn't she, in her life?
Pardon me?
She did deal with it in her life.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think part of what I treasured about her was this kind of fierce integrity to not pretend otherwise, you know?
I mean, I'm curious, because you were both poet laureates, right, of the state of Maryland.
Right.
And you were dear friends and colleagues.
I like to call ourselves co-collaborators.
Why did you say that?
Well, I mean, we worked together at St. Mary's for 15 years and worked to try to create a sense of community around poets and poetry that were committed to creating a more compassionate, more civil world. And so, I mean, that was really one of the great joys for me, of working with her at St. Mary's to do that and supporting her work in the world to try to achieve that. And it was not something we talked about explicitly that way, you know, like Lucille ever said, this is my goal, but it's certainly what I felt about her life and her work and her poetry, that deeply, deeply committed to justice and civility and humanity. I think one of her great, great gifts was her ability to talk to people in a way that included them in not being part of the problem, but rather part of the solution, even though we were part of the problem, and we all damn well knew it.
So I'd like to talk a bit about, Michael, what you think about her significance was as a poet, and maybe in that also about the significance of poetry.
I think a lot of her significance as a poet came around her courage to create spaces where our fears and our shadows could feel safe enough to emerge into the light, what places where compassion and empathy could make their claims on our lives. And that's what she struggled with in her life too. And I don't know if struggle is the right word, but that she always was working to create space in her life so that her own shadow self could emerge into the light, that the difficulties and hardships of her life could transform themselves into forces for the good, forces for life. And she worked to create that in the communities that she lived in. Her passion to make people understand that life was rarely either or, but always both and her ability to embrace paradox and the seeming contradictions of profound truths. I think that weaves its way, threads its way through all of her poetry and all of her presentations, and I think profoundly important in the world of poetry, that kind of a deep spiritual trust in the potential decency of all human beings that that carried her and carried her poems. I think that's something about something about why she's been so important to people and to poetry.
Let's go now to Lucille Clifton reading her work at the St. Mary's College of Maryland in 1990.
What I be talking about can be said in this language only. This tongue be the one that understands what I be talking about. You, are you talking about the landscape that would break me if it could? The trees my grandfolks swung from, the dirt they planted in and ate? No, what I be talking about, the dirt, the tree, the landscape, can only be said in this language. The words be hard, be bumping out, too much to be contained in one thin tongue, like this language, this landscape, this life.
Kathleen Glazer was principal at Hollywood Elementary School in 1984 when Lucille Clifton came to her school to speak to the students. Kathleen sat down with us to talk about how this incredibly powerful friendship grew and developed with Lucille Clifton after that moment.
I met her in 1984 when we brought her to the school. Of course, I, as many elementary schools did, you know, invited her not just because of her being a well-known poet, but also because of her children's books. And I think I knew that day when I was driving her from Hollywood Elementary to St. Mary's College that we could become really good friends. Just the nature of our conversation on that drive let me know we could talk about anything, including the black-white tensions in our culture that we both carried with great sadness in our hearts. And I, of course, learned so much from her. She really became, you know, after she moved to St. Mary's and, or, you know, began teaching at St. Mary's in 1989, you know, she was with our family, you know, for weekly meals. And because she didn't drive, I drove her to the grocery store and lots of places. So her friendship, you know, was a great gift to my life and a great loss. It's you know, a month ago today that her daughters called to say that, you know, they really, the doctors at Hopkins thought that she was going to die. Okay, sorry for getting...
It's okay.
I guess one of the couple of things I thought about that I had wanted to tell you is that one of the phrases she taught me, and she certainly said it to groups and libraries and schools, and she's quoting another person here. It's in my I did teach children's literature a bit at St. Mary's College, just as she had. So this is someone else's quote, and I think you could probably trace it if you wanted it. But the concept is that children's books should have windows and mirrors in them, and part of what really inspired her or provoked her really to begin creating the Everett Anderson books, and you might know this, is that as she was reading to her own children, which of course six of them born within 7 years, that she wasn't finding images of African American children in the children's books. And so when she talked to teachers and librarians, she would say, and her children's literature classes, the importance of a book having a mirror and reflection in it of the children who are reading it, and also the importance of books having windows out onto a larger world, a world that they didn't know much about. And I still, you know, she delivered truth so powerfully. I still have a vivid image of her speaking in Leonardtown Library and saying to this group, and either group, children who don't have books with mirrors in them and children who don't have books with windows on a world different than the one they're living in or larger, both of those groups are disadvantaged. And she was so insistent on those wonderful truths and just taught me so much as an educator. She would say, I don't believe in teaching, I believe in learning, and had such faith in all people's, including children's, natural curiosity and urge to learn. So I think, you know, really, this wonderful friend who is large in our family life and large in my professional life, and of course, I'm not a poet myself, but I have lived my life surrounded by poets my adult life, and treasure, you know, treasure the way that poetry speaks to the soul and nourishes our spirits. And that was the other quote, which is a Dorothy Day quote that she would say. I remember her reading at Library of Congress and saying, you know, my purpose here is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. And so many lines. I like her, her 9/11 you know, poems called September Song. She does a poem for each day, beginning with September 11th. And they've put those poems with a student idea at St. Mary's College to put those seven poems around the pond. So they are, you know, on the proper term, they're, you know, on plaques spaced around the poem, so they work around the pond, so they work like a meditation. But I was just looking at the one that's Friday, September 14th, 01, which begins, "Some of us know we have never felt safe. All of us Americans weeping, as some of us have wept before." So that wonderful inclusiveness, but always acknowledging, too, the wounds of people who have been seen in our society as less than, or, you know, not as important or not full members of our society.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So she helped me and so many others just expand our hearts to include so many more people.
Kathy, I want to just say that you may not be a poet, but your words are like poetry. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show as we celebrate the life and work of Lucille Clifton. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center. providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show as we celebrate the life and work of Lucille Clifton. We're about to talk to the great poet, Ethelbert Miller, on his remembrances of Lucille Clifton. Ethelbert's a great literary activist, and he's chairman of the board of the Institute for Policy Studies, director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University. His most recent book is The Fifth Inning, his memoir, and we are happy to be joined by him at this moment. Ethelbert, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, it's always good to talk to you, Mark.
So I'd like you just to share with us a bit about your thoughts as both a friend and a fellow poet of Lucille Clifton and what you think she represented for to and for all of us and as a poet.
Well, you know, Lucille Clifton is a writer I met in 1974, and I was introduced to her by the poet, Southern poet Amazu Bolton, who died a few years ago. Amazu Bolton was here working with me at Howard in the African American Resource Center, and he knew Lucille Clifton. He had published some of her work in, you know, some little magazines. And I had just started up my Ascension Poetry Reading series, and Amazu, you know, contacted Lucille, and Lucille came to my third Ascension program on Howard University's campus. Came down on her own, you know, no real honorarium or anything because we didn't have any money then.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's my first guest on my Ascension series. And I never forgot that, you know. And, you know, it was her first, I believe, her first reading on the campus of Howard University, a school she had attended back in the 50s. So it was a real, like a homecoming for her, and I wasn't even aware of that.
Hmm.
But I give credit, you know, to Amazu Bolton, who was very close to Lucille Clifton. In fact, I found in one of my books as I was going back, you know, through my library after Lucille died, and I found stuck in the pages of one of Lucille's books an unpublished poem that she wrote for Amos, you know.
Really?
Yeah, and it was just really nice reading that again and, you know, just brought back this sort of friendship. But what I liked about Lucille Clifton as a writer, in terms of the person I looked up to, I always felt that Lucille Clifton had an aura or glow. You know, she talks about the light, you know, coming to her.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that you really saw a woman on a spiritual path. And when we look at her work, we see this journey. You know, for example, you go back to her one of her, you know, signature poems, Good Times. You know, that is a poem which to me is very remarkable because it celebrates the black family. You know, and in that short poem, you find the African-American male presence is there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the father, the uncle, you know, everybody is in that house, and it's good times. You know, and I like that aspect of her celebrating the black family. And then in poems, Homage to Her Hips or Homage to Her Hair, you see Lucille Clifton celebrating the black body. See, you know, celebrating the black body in terms of how a black woman defined themselves, you know, with the hips, with the hair, and not apologizing for it, you know. I always felt that in these short poems that was part of her style, Lucille Clifton's poem knew how to strut. You know, they knew how to strut across the page. You know what I'm saying? And they were unapologetic, you know.
Uh-huh,
in
uh-huh.
fact, I'll read you one of my favorite Lucille Clifton poems, which is from her collection, Next.
Oh, great.
And this is a poem that when I heard it, it just resonated with me. Why some people be mad at me sometimes. They ask me to remember, but they want me to remember their memories. And I keep on remembering mine. And that's a very short poem.
Mm.
But you can say, okay, do your PhD around this.
You
know what I'm saying? You know, because this is a struggle over the control of one's narrative.
Uh-huh.
You know, this is a whole issue of identity, you know, feeling in place, out of place. You know, and also we have a tendency of projecting stories onto people, history onto other people, not realize that they have their own. You see? And we see this when we look at the issues that we're confronted with as a society around the issues of education. What is to be taught? You see, who controls the first chapter? Who's on the cover of the historical textbooks?
Mm-hmm.
You see, and in this small line, I mean, I think that when you look at Lucille Clifton, you know, she practices what we would call the, you know, the economy of words. You know, you know, what you find is this sort of, you know, minimalist style in which the poems are really compact, you know, and similar to like the how you would look at some of the poems that Langston Hughes gave us, where someone would say, well, Langston Hughes, you know, he's not Ezra Pound, you know, this poem seems a little simplistic. No. You know, these poems are like little solar cells, you know. Mm-hmm. They pack a lot of energy, and you just have to realize in terms of take the time to recognize how much power and energy are in these, you know, few lines that Lucille Clifton gives us.
And as you were speaking, Ethelbert, it made me think that just the power of her poetry, as you said, what she puts in small places, mm-hmm. the power that comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the black experience, the human experience, but also the idea that we had this incredible poet and spirit who lived among us here in this community.
Well, but see, she's in the tradition. You know, when you look at Lucille Clifton moving around this area, well, you know, keep in mind, I always tell people Frederick Douglass ran away from Maryland. you know, he knew what freedom was about. I mean, you know, I mean, he knew what it is. I mean, you know, when you look at... you know, when you look at Maryland and you're dealing with the backdrop of the Civil War and things of that sort, well, yes, okay, if Walt Whitman's going to be walking around here, so should Lucille Clifton. You know, and so she's part of the American tradition. You see? And then I look at her in terms of her spiritual growth. That's what I look at. I look at a poet who's on the path, who works, draws upon, you know, the Bible for inspiration, you know, some Buddhism for inspiration, you know. And at the same time, you find these poems that document the political changes. So you see in some of the short poems, Lucille Clifton writing about the Black Panthers. You see her writing about South Africa. So, you know, she is aware of the world around her that is changing, and it's documented in her work. And to some extent, she becomes a poet of witness.
A witness to her life, to the life of the black world, the life of our world in toto. I mean, she was all that.
Oh, yeah, and if you want to add something, you know, for Lucille Clifton passing at this time, I think this is the symbolism. She passes like the day before Valentine's Day, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of reminding us about love in our hearts, you know. Then as an example, if you look at a woman who, to me, you could just take to the hill and say, okay, you want to know why we need health care? This is what Lucille Clifton went through in her life.
mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
She would just be a test from her kidneys to, you know, every other part of her. You know? I mean, she would be a testament, you know? I think it's very painful when a mother loses their children, you know? I mean, look at how much Lucille had to deal with death, okay? And then in the later years, she became, you know, very, very public with her private life, okay? And so all of a sudden, you know, she's writing about this sort of abuse within the household. And that takes a certain courage,
right.
You see. But I, you know, if Lucille Clifton was still living, I have her on the hill. Obama, you know, this is why we need health care. Just listen to Lucille. <You know?
laughs>
And then it would be the light that came to Obama.
Well, we can only hope. That would be great.
We can only hope.
Ethelbert Miller, it's lovely to hear your remembrances of Lucille Clifton.
And one last thing I have to say. This woman was born with six fingers on each hand. That's a reminder, Mark. Six fingers.
I'll remember that.
Right. No, if those six fingers touch the back of your head, Mark, whoa. We're talking something more powerful than FM, brother.
Amen to that.
All right.
Thank you, Ethelbert.
Okay.
Let's go now to Lucille Clifton reading her work at the St. Mary's College of Maryland in 1990.
This is called White Lady. White Lady is a street name for cocaine. White Lady wants my son, wants my niece, wants Josie's daughter, holds them hard and close as slavery. What will it cost to keep our children? What will it cost to pay them, to buy them back? White Lady says, I want you. Whispers, let me be your lover. Whispers, run me through your fingers. Feel me, smell me, taste me, love me. Nobody understands you like White Lady. White Lady, you have chained our sons in the basement of the big house. White Lady, you have walked our daughters out into the streets. White lady, what do we have to pay to repossess our children? White lady, what do we have to own our own at last?
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show as we celebrate the life and work of Lucille Clifton, who left us in February, but her work will stay with us forever. And now we're talking with Kenneth Carroll, a well-known poet, a good friend of Lucille Clifton, who is a playwright and much more, nominated for the 2004 Pushcart Prize for Poetry, and joins us here. Kenneth, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Talk a bit about your relationship with Lucille Clifton and how you came to know her.
I you know, like probably millions of Lucille Clifton fans, came to know her first through her writings, and being a young poet and just finding her work just amazing, you know, really stunning. First coming upon her work and just thinking, you know, one, you know, I'd like to write with the kind of power this woman writes with. And interestingly enough, I ended up one of her poems called "Listen, Children." I remember teaching that poem to my then 5-year-old son, and he eventually memorizes the poem and reads it at school. And so that's how I really became familiar with her work and kind of fell in love with her work, and then transmitted that love to my son, my older son.
How did you first meet?
I ended up meeting Lucille Clifton, funny enough, the first time at the White House under Bill Clinton, who was having some kind of a program at the White House, and Michael Glaser was there, and I believe Grace Cavalieri, and I walked up to Lucille Clifton, and I had a recording of my son reading her poem called "Listen, Children."
Uh-huh.
And I gave her a copy of that recording, and I said, you know, my son loved your poetry, and they've actually, and in his school, in his first grade class, they were actually reading Lucille Clifton poems as part of the class.
Was she the poet laureate then?
Yeah, I believe she was the poet laureate at that time, and we talked about that. The thing about her that was so amazing to me is, you know, Lucille Clifton is just one of the most approachable people in the world. You just feel like, you know, 2 minutes into meeting her, like you've known her your whole life. And so I'm there, you know, this poet, you know, that, you know, relative to her, unknown, and yet she's talking to me like, you know, we've been old buddies, you know.
That's interesting. I mean, you talk about her being so approachable and how stunning and amazing you describe her poetry as being. I mean, that was, I guess, in some ways part of the complexity and beauty of Lucille Clifton. That she was such a serious thinker and wrote so many serious things, but was such a loving, caring, and just down-to-earth human being at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And then you learn about her life, and that you know, at the same time, this is somebody who, you know, really, at, you know, at that point, really was at, you know, I think that the height of her career. I mean, a lot of respect. Poets from everywhere talked about her work. You know, she was reading everywhere, doing visiting professorships. And like you say, she was just somebody that I think a lot of poets gravitated to because of who she was as a human being, in addition to being a great writer.
What of her poems grabs you the most? Can you remember certain ones that really just stay with you?
Yeah, I mean, I taught poetry at Arts High School here in Washington, D.C. for about 4 or 5 years.
Ellington? You taught at Ellington?
Yeah,
yes.
At Ellington School for the Arts.
Yeah.
And I used to have my students commit to memory one of Lucille's poems, Won't You Celebrate With Me, which is just a masterpiece of a poem. And part of the reason I wanted my students to memorize that piece is, you know, it's kind of, it's almost like an ars poetica for Lucille, but it's also this notion of the artist's ability to kind of, you know, make themselves, to find space in the world for themselves through the creation of their art. And to me, that's one of her most powerful pieces.
I'm curious, as you were talking about this, since you also are a very fine poet, what you think she imparts on the rest of us when it comes to the power of poetry in this world, because we often shunt poetry aside as something less meaningful than mathematics or something else.
Well, I mean, see, that and that's, you know, probably, you know, part of the difficulty for us as a society is understanding the necessity of art, you know, and I just felt like in Lucille Clifton's work, the what she brought was a kind of, you know, a non, it, even though she, you know, she was an academic and she did teach, I think her work reached, you know, beyond the academy. I think it came from a place, you know, that it was organic, that she was not writing to impress her colleagues, but, you know, really writing to reach, you know, people who, you know, work 9-to-5 jobs, or people who one wouldn't think would enjoy poetry. I mean, I think she wrote with as authentic a voice as we've seen in American literature.
That couldn't be said better from what you just said. I really do appreciate you taking this time with us today to talk about Lucille Clifton.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Won't you celebrate with me what I have shaped into a kind of life? I had no model. Born in Babylon, both non-white and woman, what did I see to be except myself? I made it up here on this bridge between starshine and clay, my one hand holding tight my other hand. Come, celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed.
To hear more about the life and work of Lucille Clifton, be sure to attend a tribute to Lucille Clifton at the Enoch Pratt Central Library this Thursday, June 24th at 6:30 p.m. Friends and fellow poets will offer remembrances of her and read selections of her work. For more information, www.prattlibrary.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Marianne Amos. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.